Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, my returning guest is poet, writer, visual artist, Frida Hughes. Her latest book is the memoir, George, a Magpie Memoir. But we're going to be talking about her other books of poetry and her paintings tonight. Frida, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Mark, thank you so much for having me back.
Well, and I want to say to the audience that, you know, I started looking at examples of your visual art, and I felt like, okay, we talked about the Magpie book, but I really wanted to talk about your visual art. Then I started reading your poetry, and I went, oh, my God, I want to talk to her about her poetry, too. So we're going to try to talk about both. I want to ask you, which came first for you, the painting or the poetry?
That was really chicken egg. When I was a very little kid, I was scribbling lines, but I was also doing doodles. And it was only as I got older I realized, you know, dad, poet, don't copy because people are just going to make comparisons. So I told people about the drawings. I didn't tell people about the poetry, but I did both. I did do both.
You know, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about, having two parents who were world-famous poets. Was that something that was daunting and that discouraged you in the beginning from doing poetry?
Oh, yes. It gave me a very good lesson in the meaning of life and living, because for years I wrote poetry. In fact, one of my English teachers, sadly now dead, who was a marvelous man, sent a collection of my teenage poetry to my father.
Whoa.
My teenage poems, I should say. Yeah, because I didn't. And he wrote and said, I'm sure that Frida hasn't shown these to you, but I think actually they're remarkably good, and you should know about them. And my father never broke the trust. He stayed mum. He never mentioned until many years later I confessed. And my teacher sent me a copy of the letter and what he'd done only shortly before he died, which was, you know, not long ago. But I thought that it was much better not to tell anybody I wrote poetry because very obviously I would get compared, and very obviously comparisons. I mean, when you look at who they are, you know, Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes,
Oh my God, it's like having Picasso and Leonardo da Vinci as your parents and then trying to paint.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it felt.
And so that shows a lot of gumption.
I've got to tell you, the lesson in life came when I was 34, developed chronic fatigue, was living in Australia, and chronic fatigue, I mean, I couldn't get out of, I mean, I wiped me out for 8 months. It was a bit longer than that, but I sort of got over it slowly. But that 8 months, I was stumped, and I couldn't read a book, couldn't do anything, couldn't think straight. And I thought to myself, I was awake 4 hours a day, 20-minute stretches, and I thought, if this is what life is going to be like, how do I want to use it?
Yeah.
And I looked at my life, and I thought, I'm not writing poetry, and I do write poetry, but I'm not showing it to anybody because I'm scared, and I'm scared of judgment, and I'm scared of what all those people I haven't met might think and say about me. And then I looked at my painting, and I was painting very, very detailed, very intense watercolors and so on, and I thought, no, I want to paint big, colorful abstracts. I want to really put it all out there. And I looked at the way I'd been living, and I thought, right, in 20 minutes a day, for a total of 4 hours a day awake, that's what I'm going to do. And I couldn't read my poems back to myself because I couldn't read, but
wow,
I could write. So in my waking minutes, I wrote poetry and I painted sunsets. And then I would just collapse. I'd do 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, and I would collapse. Sleep, wake up again, do a little bit more, collapse. And creating a stack of having work actually helped me climb out of whatever that thing is that causes chronic fatigue, because I felt a sense of achievement in amongst, you know, the few. I discovered being angry at having it was not helpful. It was very counterproductive. But that positive step was really haunting. It also taught me, don't care about what people think.
That's a huge lesson. I think it's incredibly, you know, a lot of gumption to put out. Your first book of poetry was what, Whirlew Poems?
Yes, that's right. I wrote that first draft while suffering from the worst chronic fatigue. and then I showed it to my father because I thought, if I am going to put this out in the world, I want the opinion of an expert.
So what kind of a critic was he?
I asked him to very quietly not say anything, and I said, just do three piles, Dad. Just sort of publishable and good, work onable and possible, and bad, let's not talk about it.
And how many were in the bad?
Actually, not a lot, fortunately, and a lot were in the work onable, but there were two books, there was equivalent, nearly two books in the good, in the publishable, and then there was another sort of book and a half in the work on. And there were actually not a, there wasn't a huge number in the bad, but there was one thing, and it was interesting how my mind had been sort of changed by, or the way my brain worked had been changed by chronic fatigue. Because my father said at the end, and he rather embarrassed because he knew I was feeling very self-conscious about this, I hadn't told him that I had chronic fatigue. I told no one until afterwards, except for my doctor. I didn't want to share it with anybody. And so he said, Frieda, really surprising, yes, very good. Have you ever thought about punctuation? And what I'd done was unable to punctuate. I had put nothing more than a full stop at the end of every poem. And so I ran back to my drawing board on my desk, and I looked at the poems, and as I was doing the drafts, I got better. I was getting better as I was doing the drafts. I had to cut every single poem down the middle and move the end of one line to the beginning of the next line, and then they had a better rhythm. But my rhythm, my sort of poetic rhythm during chronic fatigue was so out of kilter, I had to do that to just about every single damn poem.
Well, can we just, before I have you read a poem, or you read a poem, I'm not going to have you read a poem, talk to me about being sick in Western Australia. I mean, being sick with chronic fatigue is horrible, but to be sick and to be in such an out-of-the-way place, I've been to Western Australia,
And I was living on the edge of the bush. I wanted to be away from people, and I pretty much was.
My God, I have stories we'll share off mic, but talk to me about what the influence of the place was on your poetry.
It gave me room to breathe. It gave me room to think. It gave me room to not feel cluttered by the world around me. But after Wooraloo, into which I poured my heart and soul for that first book during the chronic fatigue, I discovered I was reusing words over and over again. So what I had was I had a vocabulary, and it was quite a decent vocabulary, but living where I did, I wasn't actually talking to many people. Kangaroos, not much conversation, you know, kookaburra, zero conversation. And I discovered that actually I really needed to engage with intelligent human beings who carry on an intelligent discussion about, you know, almost anything, because I began to run out of my vocabulary.
Yeah,
I was reusing it and using it and using it. And
you needed to hear other people speak so that you could incorporate those words.
Yeah, and also to hear other people think. And I was so left alone with my own thoughts. Very easy to forget how to talk to people, and so I did have to re-engage with the world. But in a sense, it was a good place to be ill, because if I'd been surrounded by people, you know, somebody would say, would you like coffee or tea? And I couldn't make up my mind. I would simply pass out. There's no other way to discuss. It's not like going to sleep. It's like your consciousness just shuts down. And I was able to manage it much more by only putting myself among people at the point where they, you know, where I could act out a kind of well person, you know, because I didn't want, as I say, I did not want anybody to know I had chronic fatigue until afterwards. And in fact, I've been like that with anything I have. I'll tell you afterwards, but while I'm in it, I'm not going to share.
Wow. Could you read a poem before we move? I want to make sure that we hear you read a poem before we keep talking.
I'm going to read a shortish one to start with. Actually, no. I'm going to read that shortest one afterwards. I'm going to start with Rasputin. Rasputin's a slightly longer one. Rasputin is based on a modern-day con man, and really, I've used, you know, the history of Rasputin as the background for this particular con man. Rasputin. He's selling God, you can buy the book, $6 a Bible. He sells life insurance on the side and can do a deal on a car for the cash and a ride. His wife is pregnant again, each child by a stranger. He says to the girls who want to understand his vast kindness in taking on another man's burden. If they looked a little closer, they'd see his face on each of the three. Bastards by rumor only. His wife undone and left when he found another one. But his eyes, like pointy spears darting out from their almond greens, are looking for anyone who won't ask questions and move him on. What he has seen are the voids that women carry, their wounds wanting to be stopped up and gagged. Come sin with me, he tells them, and my forgiveness will set you free. God is embedded bodily, as if I have been marked out by the gift of his most powerful blessing and made immortal. My hands are magic. And his hands performed. They took houses, cars, and checkbooks. The old and the infirm came to him, their powers of attorney flapping like winter cloaks, eager to be given to a man who promised warmth in return for their investment. When, one by one, cast out as empty, the men and women stood up in only the emperor's new clothes. They discovered he'd been poisoned once for fraud and lived, as if God acknowledged his apology. So this time, they shot him.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Mark Lynch in Inquiry. Tonight, my returning guest is poet, writer, visual artist, Frieda Hughes. Her latest book is the memoir, George, a Magpie Memoir. Frieda, there's so much I want to talk to you about your poems. One of the things I found fascinating is you sometimes have a recurring character, Stunkel.
Yes.
Talk to me about Stunkel. I don't know how many poems you've written that person is in there.
I've never counted, but he does crop up again and again. Stunkel is the creation, the man into, or the sort of gargoyle, really, into whom I pour all the worst aspects of humanity.
Well, when you were reading Rasputin, I was starting to think about Stunkel.
Stunkel's obviously had an effect on you.
Yes.
He is represented in Out of the Ashes. He does appear a few times.
Have you ever developed other characters like that? Stonepicker appears in a few poems too, doesn't he?
Well, Stonepicker and Stunkel are related. And effectively, what I started doing was creating a little ghastly family of all the relatives that you've never wanted to have. I did a reading once with Stonepicker, who was actually the title poem of one of the books, which is largely included in Out of the Ashes. And I did a reading, and I walked out, and I'm walking to my car, and it's dark, it's late at night, it's winter, and these footsteps come pounding after me, and I start to speed up a bit because I'm a little worried. And the footsteps speed up a bit, and finally this person catches up with me, grabs hold of my arm, and it's a woman, and she turns me around, and she says, "I didn't know you knew my sister."
Whoa!
And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry, what do you mean?" She said, "Your poem, Stonepicker, magnificent." She said, "It's spot on." And it is about, Stonepicker is about a woman who collects grievances, calls you close, but not to let you in, only for a better aim. And she collects grievances against you like stones in her shoulder bag.
Wow. I have to talk to you about your art, your visual art. It's fascinating because you've done figurative art, but you seem to really dwell in abstraction. Have you always been attracted to abstraction?
No, hated it. Actually, never wanted to be an abstract artist, ever, ever, ever.
Okay, explain to me why you had that reaction.
Abstract art, because when I was growing up, abstract art didn't mean anything to me, and everything was about me wanting to render animals, trees, rocks,
right.
The things that I love to look at, and that's one of the things I so loved about Australia. The rocks, the trees, and the intensely black shadows made everything come alive and be bright, and, blindingly bright. It was so, it was intoxicating, really, for me as an artist. And then a bushfire. Actually, Australia's had a big effect on me in all kinds of ways. Bushfire, first week of 1997, went through my property. I only managed to say the little kit home I lived in, the little bungalow I lived in, only survived because I painted the bottom 6 inches of all the posts with flame retardant paint. It does what it says on the tin. It saved the house.
Wow.
But all the other buildings and my studios went up in flames. All the neighbors' houses went up in flames. It was the biggest bushfire in West Australian history at that point. And the animals were cooked in the fields. I had vast trees on my property. I only had 15 acres, but I had vast trees on the property. They burned on the ground for days until there was nothing but a black handprint of black ash on white ash of the grass. It was extraordinary. And I wrote poems about fire. I couldn't sleep. I found it difficult to eat. The fire was devastating. And day after day, I would pace the land trying to, you know, rescue bits of what had been my home. And so I painted it, and I painted fire painting after fire painting, and it took years to sell them because not the biggest seller, you can understand, you know, horses, rabbits, you know, anything else sells quicker, owls. But what I couldn't do was paint my fury and my anger at this fire, and it had been set by an arsonist. It was started by somebody who had a grudge against, guess what, the local fireman, funnily enough, and I lived surrounded by firemen on farms. So I looked at what I was doing, and I couldn't get that passion into the paintings. And so I thought, well, what if I simply take the subject out and paint my feelings? And that was how I came to abstract art.
Wow.
And so now I'm two people. I've got these two halves. There's the Frida who paints figuratively and the things I love to look at and that give me joy, the trees, the rocks, the animals, the birds. And then there are the abstracts, which are my very emotional, sort of impassioned reaction to what affects me. And in that way, I managed to get those, you know, these sort of terrible feelings out. I mean, it can be love, it can be sorrow. I mean, when my brother died in 2009, I didn't want to be a useless piece of human being, and I was so upset and had to deal with all his estate, his, you know, chattels and everything else. It was awful. So what I did was I put myself in front of a canvas, I turned on the rock music really loud, and I put everything I felt onto the canvas. And I did some of my favorite paintings,
like
the Transition series. And into them, because happiness is never wholly happy, and misery and sorrow is never wholly miserable and sorrow. There's always something that creeps in that's got a little bit of joy in this, in sorrow, or a little bit of sorrow in the joy. And so then you get light and shade. And in fact, when you have a life that is a contrast, a sort of combination of both sides, you have a fantastic palette to choose from. Whereas if everything was just wonderfully happy, and I've painted days of my life where I've been superbly happy, and I have to be honest, very, very sweet paintings, very prosaic, you know, blues and pinks and yellows are lovely. but when I've been, you know, if I've had flu, or I've had, you know, something's gone horribly wrong, or one of my beautiful animals or owls died, wow, then you get the contrast. And then there are some really interesting paintings.
Even the names of your paintings refer to internal states, the idea of anxiety, the idea of hope.
The idea of hope was my partner saying to me when he saw the Transition series after my brother died.
Yeah.
We met about a year later. He said, "They're a bit hectic," he said, because he's a very calm man. He's a very calm individual, which helps. And he said, "You know, can't you paint something a little softer?"
Oh, God.
And I thought, what is the one thing that, you know, keeps us all going? It's hope. And it's the idea of hope. You know, because what is hope? What does hope look like? But the idea of hope is whatever you're after. You know, the idea of hope is getting out of whichever horrible situation you're in. You know, somebody locked you in a room, you hope to get out of it. That's a very specific hope. Anyway, so I painted the idea of hope, which is very soft, because it's like the shapes and the things that you could reach for are behind slightly frosted glass.
You actually have published a book where you combine both of your arts.
I have, Alternative Values.
Talk to me about that now. The poems came first, then the paintings?
The poems came first in most cases, And in some cases, they came sort of together. I mean, there's one called Playing Gods. It definitely came, the painting came afterwards, and the gods are depicted as sort of rocks.
It's a fascinating book because in some cases, the text is part of the painting.
Yes, I actually had somebody come to the art show that followed it and say, I want the painting, but I don't want the text on the painting. I want to see what's under the text. Is there any way you can peel it off? You
know? Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
She did complain, but then she bought the painting, and she bought the painting and went off very happy, apparently. So that was all right. But yes, some of them were painted very much. The painting was around the poem and painted very... So specifically, yes, the paintings were painted sort of pretty much after the poems or during.
Wow.
There's a couple in here. I wish we had time because,
Well, you have another poem that you want to read. Do you want to read that poem? You said it was a shorter poem?
It's a shorter poem. It is. And it is about a glamour model who changed her mind.
Hmm.
That's all I'm going to say. And it's called Breasts. Scarred beneath their bags of heavy silicon, Scarred beneath their bags of heavy silicon, they were mountains shored up and sharpened a handful of the mine's mud at a time. Those breasts weren't for a limp sweater or a bra size more than two saucers. Those breasts had purpose. Men's eyes would unpage magazines for a sight of them. Melissa was no longer required to speak. Her breasts could talk. They had a language, and everyone understood. When at last she made the photo shoot, she gently placed her breasts of shiny plastic flesh upon the table for the cameraman and left.
When I read that poem, I was hoping you would sort of read that poem.
I have to be honest, I was on a TV show once a few years ago, and I walked in, and the editor of Nuts magazine, which is a sort of lightweight porno magazine over here, I don't know if you have it over there, he was one of the guests, and we were in the green room, and he looked up at me and said, oh, you're Peter Hughes, and he said, I love your poems, and I looked at him, and I said, but you're the editor of Nuts magazine. He said, yes, he said, and the one I like is Breasts.
Really? Did he actually read the poem or just the title?
Found it on the internet.
At a moment like that, have you ever wondered, are people really understanding what they're reading?
I don't know. The only way I ever find is if they come to a reading and then they ask me questions. I wrote a poem called Landmines, and it's landmines, and it's about the spirit of your limbs being left behind. You know, if your leg blows off, the spirit of your leg go and wait for the rest of your spirit to join it. And a man put his hand up in an audience afterwards, and he said, is that the answer to your father's poem to your mother about Spain?
Whoa.
I said, no, it's actually about having limbs missing and the spirit of the limb going to wait for you. No, not about Spain and my father's poem at all. I do not know how he got, you know, my father's poem about Spain out of that, but he did.
Yeah, that always amazes me because you always wonder, as an artist, like what people are going to take away from your work. And when you have an interaction like that, you realize, God, people are just spinning stories in their head all over the place.
Well, that's one of the reasons it's actually really great to read in front of an audience because then I can iron out all the creases
at
the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when I first started, I was so terrified of getting, you know, doing questions and answers because I thought, oh my God, I don't know what they're going to ask me. And then I thought, well, I don't actually care because they're my poems and I've got all the answers. So as long as they're only asking me about my poems or my life, you know, they can ask me about my life and I cannot tell them as much as they want or as much, you know, I can tell them, I can divulge things if I choose to. But no, it's interesting. A live audience is quite something.
Have you ever had a disastrous reading?
No, I haven't. Except in, I read at Harvard.
Uh-oh.
And the heating was so, it was winter, And it was very, very cold. And the heating was on so high, I thought I was going to pass out. And I noticed that everybody was feeling very much like me. And so I really poured all my energy into changing the sort of timbre and the work, my speech patterns, to make sure that there were, you know, nothing more than 5 minutes and a change, and or 10 minutes and a change. And finally, I had to say, you know, please, could somebody throw open the windows? You know, it was.
Oh my God.
There was one. I think my there was one enormous audience in actually Smith College. I read at Smith College as well, and the audience was delightfully huge. And it wasn't a disastrous thing. I just thought it was quite funny. You Americans put ice in all the water.
Oh yeah.
And I had a swig of water, and I've got the mic taped to me, and I suddenly realized I've got a mouthful of ice and I don't know what to do with it, and I have two choices. I either swallow these enormous cubes, or I have to make them small enough to swallow easily. And so I sort of experimentally bit them, and there was this resounding crunch that just about sent everybody under the chairs.
Oh God, would you like to read another poem or talk more?
But I can read.
We only got 5 minutes left. I mean, I had a ton of things I want to talk to you about. I wanted to talk to you about sheep, because you seem to paint an awful lot of sheep. But then I also wanted to talk to you about the poem called My Mother, about the note that you wrote about that poem, and that really struck me, and I felt so bad for you.
I'm just trying to think. Mother, where would that be? That will going to take me too many valuable seconds to find that.
It's the one in it's in Stonepicker and the Book of Mirrors. I forget which one. But the note was about the film and how horrible. And, you know, it was one of those things.
I was on a plane coming from New York once, and somebody said, and behind me, they said, "Oh, look, they've got the film Sylvia on here." And I it was all I could do to sit in my seat and not climb over the top and look at them and say, "No, don't watch it. It's got a miserable ending, and you don't want to see it."
To have something like that happen to you, and it must happen to other people in other films too, but to just have that sort of out and about, and as you say, to have people say things that they never said. And to have
it's the saying things they never said. When you put things into people's mouths and say things they never said, it's impossible. And for a relative or a child, specifically a child, and I love it because people, of course, say, "Well, it's not like you're 10. Well, no, it doesn't matter whether I'm 10 or 60. I'm still their child.
Frieda, we're going to have to stop. We've run completely out of time.
Oh no!
We're going to you can come back. You can you have carte blanche to come back anytime you want. Tonight, my returning guest has been poet, writer, visual artist Frieda Hughes. Her latest book is the memoir George, a Magpie Memoir. And I have to come back and talk more about your visual arts, Frieda. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.